Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Thank you for joining us here on the Back of the Cinema podcast. And I am Zo, that's Z-O or Z-O if you're somewhere else outside the United States where your Z's or Z's. And I'm sorry, I'm just never going to understand it, but there it is. This is the 61st episode. Thank you for downloading and streaming. Really appreciate that. The reason we started this show was to strengthen the bond between my son, Zach, and me, Zo. We watched movies that I loved when I was growing up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I'm going to tell you what Zach thought about these classic movies. And we just watched one just moments ago. Now, if you like this show, then rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podchaser.com, or your favorite podcast app. Finally, please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, at Backlick Cinema Podcast, or on Twitter, at Backlick Cinema, and you can find the details in the show notes. And now, as promised, last week, I have a very special guest for you. You may have seen him appearing on Gotham from the Gotham TV show on Fox, or Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, or Drunk History, or The Letterman Show, or Nurse Jackie, or Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. He's been on television. He's a stand-up comedian. You may have heard his comedy album. You may have seen his comedy on YouTube. But right now, we have him on this show because I heard his podcast. It is Weird AF News. And it's funny. It's irreverent. It's just 10 minutes out of your day to listen to some of the funniest content that you can get off of your telephone. Ladies and gentlemen, I have here with me my very special guest, Jonesy. Welcome, Jonesy. Thank you so much for being here.
Man, I'm so flattered and humbled. That's one of the best introductions I've ever had in my life. That's like, oh man, it was like I felt I was about to win an Oscar or something. It was really, really great, man. That was just awesome. The only thing that would have been better is if you said all that while wearing a tuxedo. That would be.
Well, who says that I'm not? Nobody can see us.
Oh, they can't see. Oh, so, hey, they don't know. He's actually not wearing a shirt, everybody. He's not wearing it. What kind of movie are we going to cover today?
Yeah. Right.
This is great. So I just want to thank you for reaching out to me. You were really cool. You seemed to be very excited to have me on your show. And that was like why I immediately agreed to do it. Because, you know, if someone wants me really bad and wants to have a chat with me and they're excited about it, that gets me excited, too. And the fact that you think I have something to offer to your listeners. It's very flattering. I'm grateful to be here. And I really love movies. So I'm excited to talk about that. I do have a very popular weird news podcast, and I'm very much into weird, very weird, weird movies. Today's movie, not so weird, a classic, a true classic. I would categorize it as a Western movie, but surprisingly, I had never seen it. And so I was excited to watch it. I really enjoyed it. And I'm excited to talk about it in a way that, you know, your listeners today can learn something and also be entertained with it at the same time. So thank you.
Okay. You know, it's funny. Had I known that you were very interested in weird movies, I probably would have forced Zachary. This would have been a forced watching. I would have forced him to watch Buckaroo Banzai. And
Buckaroo Banzai. So is this is that a weird Western movie?
Oh my God, it's so weird. It's kind of like a combination of weird and sci-fi. And it is like the weirdest movie that you have ever watched. So when you get the chance, and you may not understand, how does it go? I think it's Buckaroo Banzai and the Invasions of the Eighth Dimension or something like that. It stars Peter Weller and a couple of other guys. Oh, Withlow, what's his name? The guy from Harry and the Hendersons,
John Lithgow.
Yes, that guy. He's in it. Yeah. He turns up the weird. You've seen Lithgow being weird, but this is the weirdest he has ever been. Yeah.
Okay.
Because he plays an alien. So
wow, this sounds fascinating. I really like movies that are extremely strange like that you have to watch like three times before you can kind of really figure out what's going on. You know, I'm really a fan of David Lynch's work. I would say he's a little he's a little weirder than the mainstream. I'd say he isn't crazy weird, but that's weird enough. You watch a David Lynch movie, like you really don't know what's going on half of the time. So I really love stuff that skews that way. So this Buckaroo Banzai movie, this sounds like something I need to check out for sure.
Yeah. Buckaroo Banzai is definitely, it's a must watch for you. And then the only other movie I can think of right now is, you've probably seen it, Spaceballs.
I love Spaceballs. Anything Mel Brooks is great anyways. And even his the Western that he did. What was that one called? I really love that one too.
Oh, Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles. Yeah, that was fabulous. That was fabulous. I like Mel Brooks a lot. Yeah, he's an odd guy. Very twisted sense of humor. I love it. I really enjoy it very much. Very irreverent as well, which you don't see a lot in comedy movies now. Everyone's trying to be so safe, you know? Mel Brooks wasn't afraid to insult all sorts of religions, ethnicities, genders. He just went kind of crazy with that.
Right.
I feel like those days are kind of over in our cinema, you know?
Right, right. And then there's Mel. Oh, are you familiar with his son Max Brooks and his works?
No, I'm not.
So Max Brooks wrote World War Z.
Brad Pitt movie?
Yes. Yeah.
I've seen that, I believe.
Yeah, he wrote the book that the movie is based on. And the book is way better than a movie. And in a different way, though. It's better in that it's written as a collection of interviews. So this is after the zombies have been defeated. So these are recollections that people have of fighting the zombie apocalypse.
So his son is more of a sci-fi fiction writer, like of novels.
Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
I can't remember.
I want to say
he wrote like a survival guide to zombies, and I can't remember the other thing he wrote, but he did write. As a matter of fact, regarding World War Z, he wrote, there were two audiobook editions of it. So the first audiobook edition is like a regular book with, I think it's just a couple of guys doing the narration. And then the second edition of the audiobook, he has a bunch of huge stars that are narrating the book. So so in the narration, have people like Mark Hamill and that's the only one I can remember. But it's a bunch of different actors narrating the book because they're different interviews. So each actor does an interview recounting their events of World War Z. So they're both, my point is, very talented. And so
It sounds like I need to look into his son Max here. I had no idea.
Yeah.
What a genius family over there, huh?
Right. Cool. Yeah, absolutely. So, and did you know that Max Brooks has another movie coming out? I forgot what it was, but he is supposed to be making another movie. So that's gonna be awesome.
Great, cool.
Yeah, he's like 90 years old. But I'm excited that he's going to do another movie. So like my listeners know that I like to do interviews of my guests. My listeners also know that I absolutely suck at asking questions of the people with whom I do these interviews. I'm going to ask you some very basic, unsophisticated questions.
Okay.
I've watched your channel. I've read some of your notes, some of the things out there, some of your blogs, trying to find the least dumb questions that I could ask. All right. So poking your seatbelt.
Okay. I'm ready.
It's going to get groovy. So first, super obvious question. What inspired you to be a comic and who's your biggest influence?
You know, when I was a young kid, this is not popular to say these days, but when I was an extremely young boy, I came across a DVD, a comedy DVD that my stepfather used to watch. It's called Bill Cosby Himself. Right now, people don't want to admit these days what a comedy genius that Bill Cosby was, but that Bill Cosby Himself special is really a work of greatness. It's unlike anything I've ever seen since then, actually. This is a master storyteller, and it's tremendous. It's absolutely tremendous. Any fan of stand-up comedy that hasn't seen that is really not covering all the bases, in my opinion. And I just was blown away by that. Like, someone could hold a crowd like that. I'd never seen that before, that one person just sitting down talking. He's just it's very low key. He just sits in a chair and talks. Nothing extravagant. There's no big backdrop. It's just a dude talking on a microphone. It's so raw. It's so real. It's just like, it's the way mankind's been doing it since we learned language, you know, sitting around a fire. This guy could hold a crowd like nobody's business. I thought that was the coolest thing. Never did I think I'd ever try it. I just watched that thing over and over again, though. But then years later, a close friend of mine tried stand-up comedy, went to an open mic. I went with him to watch because I was curious. Like, I kind of wanted to see my friend fall on his face. You know, it was like that kind of thing. I'm like, you're not going to be funny. Let's see this. Let's see this. You're an idiot. This ain't going to work out. And he went and he was okay. What stood out, though, was how bad everybody else was. If you've ever been to a comedy open mic, you can see it's just really terrible. The level of comedy going on here. It's all new people trying to do it. And I thought to myself, well, shit, I could at least do it as well as these people, you know. And then I was helping my buddy with his jokes after the show. And then I thought I contributed some pretty good ideas. And I thought to myself, well, it seems like I know how to do this. I think I could try it. Let me put together a little 5-minute set and I'll go with you next time. And then, you know, and then I tried it and it was, you know, it didn't go very well for me. But oftentimes, you know, your first time, it doesn't go very well. I mean, unless you're Dave Chappelle, the legend is that he just crushed from day one, but most of us don't, that doesn't happen. And I found it to be challenging. You know, I was like, oh, let me figure this out. I think I could figure this out. I think I could do this. I've always kind of been a somewhat funny person, so I've been told, and I've always been a pretty good storyteller. And I just kept trying it. And now here we are many, many years later. So I'm still doing it. And my friend that I went with way back in the day, he stopped a long time ago. It's a hard road. So, but I'm still doing it. And I still have an excitement for it and a thrill for it. Luckily. And I hope that answers your question.
Yes, absolutely.
A little long there.
That's all right. Well, see, here's the thing. Two things can be true at the same time. So there are two things that are true about Bill Cosby. And one of those things that is true is that he is one of the funniest comedians of all time. He's a brilliant comedian. And no, I don't think anybody is going to deny that. So he's one of my heroes too when I was growing up. I mean, you had Bill Cosby himself, you had the Cosby Show, you had Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. It was brilliant in the beginning before you knew anything about him. So like you, I watched Bill Cosby himself when I was real young, and it was like one of the funniest things that I've ever seen. And everything seems so true. Like a lot of the things that he talked about was true in my own family, as well as apparently in his family growing up. So, yeah.
It's such a great special. It really, you can go back and watch it. It's timeless. It's stuff that we still do. Going to the dentist, taking care of children, you know, that kind of stuff. We just all, that whole joke about taking his wife when she's in labor, bringing her into the hospital. Like, all that stuff is timeless, man. It still holds up today.
Yeah. So have you heard about, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just had to ask this. So W. Kamau Bell has a special, I think it's on HBO or one of the streaming services about Bill Cosby. I think it's called Discussing Bill Cosby, where basically he talks to a bunch of people, including many comedians, about the legacy of Bill Cosby. Have you heard of that?
I haven't. And he did this recent, like after everything?
Yeah, he did it. I think it came out like a month ago.
Oh, I didn't know about that. No, I had no idea.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I've been planning on checking it out when I got the time, but yeah, just check it out. And basically he talks about Bill Cosby and his legacy and everything. So it's like one of those things that is like, and this happened shortly after he was released from prison. So I think because Bill Cosby was also one of his heroes, and he's been a comedian for a long time. So I think he decided that, you know, we've got to talk about Bill Cosby, right? So he put this, it's like a documentary special together.
No, that's so really cool.
Yeah.
I'd be fascinated to see what other comics say about him or dare to say about him now, you know.
Right, right. I mean, I think they say the same thing as you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I freely admit how much that influenced me and what a great piece of work of art it is. I think there's a sort of a trend in the culture now to not separate the artist from the artwork or the person from the artwork. And so some people don't feel comfortable admitting that they like the artwork of somebody who is a monster personally. I think that's a sign. I think that's kind of immature, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think a mature individual can appreciate a piece of artwork outside of the personal, you know. I mean, it's pretty, everybody knows that Hemingway was a drunk monster too. All right. But we don't walk around condemning him, and everybody, you know, it's very clear that Dostoevsky, probably one of the greatest Western prose writers of all time, author of Crime and Punishment, Brothers Karamazov, all these great novels, he was an he was an inveterate like gambler to the point where, you know, he would gamble away everything where his kids couldn't even eat, you know, but he wrote some of the greatest novels ever. We don't walk around and openly condemn him either. I mean, I think there's, you can find a lot of, man, I mean, there's just so much, there's a lot of worth in artwork outside of the person. If it's very worthy, if it's very high level, art can transform culture. You know, it's that powerful. And if it is that powerful and that valuable, I think we need to look at it a little bit differently than we sometimes do. That's just my opinion.
Right, right. I think there are, it's a tricky ride. It's a tricky road to travel. So I believe that there are some people that can separate the artist from the art and enjoy the art. And there's some people that won't ever be able to. But yeah, that's a pretty tricky road.
Yeah.
So flipping over, oh, my audience also knows I am no good at Segway. So I'm going to shift this almost 360 degrees. Oh, ooh, no, okay. 120. Actually, it's 120 because if I flipped it around 360, then I'll turn around and face the same way.
Yes, you will.
I learned that from watching, what was that? The Last Action Hero. So,
going on.
Yeah.
You're always referencing movies. You're amazing.
Yeah. Going to the next question. How did you get through the pandemic and the quarantine and all that, and with the venues shutting down? And did you do virtual shows?
I tried it about 5 shows into it. I sort of stopped. It wasn't a great experience for me. Kind of, you know, doing Zoom comedy shows, it can be kind of just very humbling. It's like, oh, I bombed and you saw my shitty apartment. Great. So I don't know. I just kind of stopped doing it. And, you know, they didn't pay very much as well. It was like 10 bucks or something. And I just was, I'm not really getting anything out of this. I don't feel good. It just seemed like everyone was doing it out of boredom. I already had something to do. I was recording my podcast 5 days a week still. So I was still keeping busy creating content. A lot of my comedian friends that don't have a podcast or anything else going on, they were doing the Zoom shows almost every day, Zoom open mics. They were just doing that just to feel like they were being productive. But I didn't need to do that. I had something that it's an outlet for me to express my humor, and it's content, and it's a 5 day a week show, and I'm very busy with it. So I was able to still keep busy. I did miss doing stand-up comedy live in front of a crowd. But eventually that came back too. And I didn't have to move to Texas to do it. I just waited it out here in California. And eventually, you know, we had outdoor shows to start. And then eventually they moved indoors. And now here we are. Like last night, I did a show indoors and there's no more mask mandate. And so the, you know, it kind of felt like it did 3 years ago.
Yeah. Cool. I've watched a couple of, they were basically comedy. They're not Zoom comedy. So there's Christopher Titus. So what he did was he had like YouTube live shows, and he basically got some of his comedian friends and they did a YouTube live show, and he had like a tiny audience of basically his friends. Because this is like deep in the pandemic, right?
Oh,
so
yeah, okay.
He could only have people over that he knew were either keeping safe or he knew were vaccinated. But like early on, it was like no vaccine. So just people that he felt confident that were not infected, right? So, and those shows were rough. And the main reason is because, yeah. As I understand it, comedians require an audience to sharpen their knives, right? You can't really put out good comedy if you don't have proper audience feedback. And it's very hard to do when you have a tiny audience. It's very hard to do when you have like a Zoom audience where you can't really get a feedback. There's no back and forth, right? So
yeah, I would describe it as such a, you know, it's a dialogue between you and the audience. So when you're kind of missing the crowd and you can't see the crowd, especially, it's really hard to gauge what's going on. I guess, like, I don't know. Imagine if you were a painter, but you couldn't see all the aspects of the canvas and you're kind of just slapping paint. Some of the places in the canvas you could see, so you were nailing it there, but then other places there was a void and you couldn't see and you kind of were guessing, oh, I put some paint over here. Does it connect? Does it look okay? I don't know. That might be a lame analogy, but I'm trying to come up with a way for your listeners to kind of get a grasp of what it feels like to do a Zoom comedy show. There's a disconnect there, not a complete disconnect, because, you know, you are getting a little bit of feedback and you can on your screen kind of see a few of the people. But there's an element missing that that I need for sure. I know that by attempting these Zoom shows. Like, I'm not going to do that again ever. I'd rather not do any shows at all than that. That's me personally.
Right. Well, that's a lot of people. There are a lot of people that have tried doing it that way, and that they were unsatisfied with the experience. And I've noticed that, like, when you can't go out and you can't interact with a live audience, it's very difficult, at least from the perspective of the comedians that I've listened to on, like, different podcasts and shows and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, I had something, and then I lost it. So we're going to move on.
No problem.
There's another movie I could reference, but I'm going to skip that reference. So I read a couple of your articles, and you had done, like, a warm up show on Naomi Judd's, I guess, her only.
Oh, you read
show.
That?
Yeah, yeah. I read.
Okay. That's a good read.
Yeah. So yeah. And they're very funny. They're very personable, and I was, like, flabbergasted. Like, why did they have you on for, like, over an hour? That's unkind and unprofessional. And There was a huge list of censored words. They couldn't put that. Well, actually, censored topics, which is ridiculous. And why couldn't they have put that in the ads? It's like, I think what they would rather have had, there are some people that don't actually tell jokes. They just tell stories that might have some humor in it. And I've seen a couple of people like that. So I think that's who they wanted. They didn't want you because you're a comedian and that's not what you do. Like, you can't cut out, like, every possible subject. You can't cut out relationships. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So for your listeners who are wondering what we're talking about here is, you know, when I was a young comic in New York City, just I would take any job I could. I was applying for all sorts of anything comedy related or hosting related, or just I wanted to be on the microphone, you know. So, you know, you'll MC, like, weddings if you can. Some comics will do that, you know, anything that puts you in front of a crowd. If you can make some money, you do it. So there's a job called a crowd warm-up, a warm-up comedian. A lot of live shows have a comedian come out and say, hey, welcome to the show, we're about to shoot this live show, anybody seen a live show taping before, who's first time, and where you're from, and you get them going, you go, all right, guys, ready, and then out comes whatever, Jimmy Kimmel comes out, hey, and the show starts. Now usually that comedian only does about 10 minutes, 5 minutes, because it doesn't really take that much to get a big crowd excited. The problem with the job that I was hired for was it wasn't a big crowd. It was about 12 people. It was a new show. It was a religious-based show. The host of the show, Naomi Judd, it was her first TV gig of some sort. She's more known as a musician, so she was trying to get into TV. So the show wasn't really known. The crowd was small. It's a religious-based show on a Hallmark channel. So, you know, a lot of my material had to be really squeaky clean. And at that time, I was a really young comic, and I didn't have a lot of clean material. You know, I was really young. I was talking about sex and dating, you know, that kind of stuff that you talk about when you're in your mid-20s, early 20s. You know, those are what, if you go, you know, any young comic usually will talk about such subjects. And I swear a lot. I was swearing a lot. I'm from Boston. I had just moved from Boston. And so I was, you know, I drop a lot of F-bombs. And so I had to, like, be mindful of that. It just wasn't a good fit for me. And not only that, they just really didn't know what they were doing. And it, you know, what normally would have been a 10-minute, 15-minute warm-up, 15-minute would be a longer warm-up. This, you know, she just wasn't ready to come out of her dressing room. I don't know how long it took her for to get the hair done and the makeup. But, like, you know, I was out there for over an hour. That's just unheard of. It's unheard of. And I had about maybe 20 minutes of clean material at tops to get through. It just was, and then the crowd wasn't big enough to do crowd work. You know, I mean, like,
it's 12, and you tried.
There's 12 people. I mean, after you go, where are you from? Where are you from? Now I've just asked everybody. I mean, there's nobody left to ask where you're from and talk about where they're from. There's just no. I ended up just kind of walking around with the microphone, interviewing the cameraman. Hey, what do you do, cameraman? Hey, did you guys ever wonder what a cameraman does? Let's find out. Let's talk to the janitor for 5 minutes. Let's find out where he's from. You know, I just was completely running out of things. And you know, it wasn't a good impression for the show producers, but, you know, not completely my fault. And I wasn't asked to come back, that's for sure.
Right, right.
It was a good experience, though, because any sort of adversity on the microphone makes you just stronger. So that was that was crazy. That was a crazy experience. That is not typical at all.
Right,
it's just,
right.
It's just not. And there was a perfect storm of factors that made it. I was going to fail.
The amazing thing is that you, I mean, in spite of everything, in spite of all of that adversity, you kept it going, knowing that it was something that you basically did more than you have to do, right? So
yeah, well, hey, you know, I was being paid, and you know, I want to keep it professional, so I just and it was a new experience for me, and I just thought, well, maybe it goes like this sometimes. Maybe this is what happens sometimes. No,
that's
really not. And that never happens. It never happens. Every friend of mine that does warm up, and I'm friends with a few comics that do it, I tell them that story. They never believe it. They can't believe it.
Right.
Yeah, they've never heard of such a thing happening before. It's unheard of.
Absolutely.
Lucky me, I got to have that. And they made a good story, you know, and I'm very flattered that you took the time to read that. I got some stories on a Medium blog under Funny Jones that I shared some fun tales of like sort of adverse stand-up comedy experiences that in hindsight are pretty funny, you know?
Yeah.
Tragedy plus time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what encouraged you to start your own podcast? I really like the podcast going over the weird news. I listen to like maybe 3 or 4 weird news podcasts, and I'm just adding yours to the collection.
Oh, I don't even know there were that many.
They're a bunch.
Do any of them do it daily?
No, absolutely not. You're the only one that's daily. You're the only one that's doing that out of your closet. And you're the only one that's doing it out of your closet with a microphone or a computer. You're the only one.
Yeah, I do. I record it in a closet, which is one of the things that my listeners find hilarious. And they, you know, I get a lot of emails. You don't really record in a closet, do you? Yeah. Yes, I do. and on my Patreon, my patrons, I write their name on the closet, AKA the studio wall. So if you join my Patreon, you get your name up on the studio wall. Isn't that pretty cool? Right. Basically in the closet. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, I was approached by a friend who had gotten a job working for a brand new podcast platform called Anchor. It's a place you can make a podcast for free. And they didn't have a lot of users yet or content creators. And they were trying to get some professional content creators on their podcast so that we have content from daily sports, daily music news, daily tech, finance. You know, they gave me a bunch of choices, entertainment news. And I, being a sports freak, I volunteered to do the sports one. I could talk about sports every day. I'm a huge sports fan, but I'm not familiar with finance and tech and all that other stuff. So and you know, talking about that stuff every day would have felt like work to me. So I said, I'll do the sports one. And, the guy said, oh, sorry, the sports one's already taken. I said, I'm not really interested in any of these other categories. What if I pitch a show to you? Would you be interested in hearing such a thing? And he said, yeah. So then I came up with, how about I do daily weird news? How about that? There's a lot of weird news in the world. And I'm sure there's enough material to do a show every day about some weird stuff going on in the world. And they said, well, why don't you record an example of this and send it over? And so I did. And they just loved it. And they're like, yeah, let's do this. You got a daily weird news. Tell us what you want it to be called, and we'll feature you on the app. And they paid me. I had a contract. It was like an 8-month contract. So I just did that for straight up pay from the company. And my show ended up being the most popular one of them all, really. I had a lot of users on there, a lot of subscribers. I was getting a lot of phone calls and messages on the app about it, and kind of built a kind of a cult following. And so when the contract was up, they said, hey, we can't pay you anymore, but if you'd like to continue to do this, you know, we'll feature you on the platform, and you know, you can just kind of make it your own now if you'd like to. You don't have to do it every day. You can do whatever you want with it. It's yours. And so I thought, well, should I still do this? I'm not getting paid anymore. Is there a way to make money off a podcast? I started researching, how do you make money off a podcast? Well, you go get sponsorships. Okay, maybe you create a Patreon, a way for listeners to donate to you. And you know, it seemed to me like it was possible. I'd have to start from square one, but I had a nice following already and fans of the show. So I thought it was possible. And I also felt, I kind of would have felt weird if I just abandoned it like that, because I had made these connections with listeners and they were very loyal. And like, what kind of person would I be if I just abandoned something that everybody seemed to enjoy? And I've done a lot of things in my life that, and hardly anyone ever really enjoyed it like this, you know, like a lot of stand-up comedy. I've been on TV shows and I've done some writing and I've even played music. Nobody ever enjoyed the other things that I've created as much as it seemed these listeners of the show enjoyed it. It just really affected them. I was a part of their lives daily. I was getting messages like, you helped me get through rehab. You helped me get through the death of a loved one. Like, I was kind of like touching people on some level that I had never done before. So I felt like abandoning it would be unfair and an injustice. And I'm like, why not continue to do something that people seem to embrace? And now here we are. And now it's been over 1,000 episodes and 4 years of this. And I'm actually making some money, not a lot, but you know, I make enough to keep doing it. And it's like, it's now just kind of a part of my life and who I am. And I'm glad I took the opportunity, and I'm glad I continued to do it after the contract was up. So yeah. Weird AF News is now a thing. The only daily weird news podcast. And it's just growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, it is. It is very entertaining. I really love the stories.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
My favorite story, I think that you did, was the guy who's, I think you would have wanted it, the guy whose penis got frozen off or something like that.
Oh, the Olympic skier.
Yeah.
With the frozen penis.
Yeah.
Was that, I think that was Monday, or was it the end of last week? Yeah.
I can't remember when I heard it, but yeah, I'm like, oh my God, that yeah, is weird, right? And when does that happen? Like, it's like, I've never heard of, like, Olympic skiing has been around for decades, and this is the first time I've ever heard of somebody's penis being frozen off, or just frozen. I mean,
I'd imagine I'd imagine it happens a lot, given what they're forced to wear in that event. I mean, a very aerodynamic light spandex type suit that's just meant for speed and not for warmth or coverage.
Oh my God. So I would have.
So it's a problem. So I'd imagine this isn't the first time. I mean, look at that outfit. They've been wearing that outfit for decades in these sports.
Right.
I mean, I'd imagine this is a common thing, but nobody ever really talked to the media about it until now.
Like, man, that's crazy. I have so much padding around my penis. Speaking of penis, we will be talking about dicks later on in this episode when we talk about the movie. So Right. So let us transition over to, I'm on the wrong page. Let us transition over to the movie that we have watched. Because as I said, there is some dick conversations and some horniness going on in this movie. And the movie that we have watched was Unforgiven. And why don't you go ahead and read us the description of this movie provided by IMDb.
The Unforgiven is about a retired old West gunslinger named William Money. William Money reluctantly takes on one last job with the help of his old partner, Ned Logan, and a young man called the Schofield Kid.
Yes. And so this movie was released on August 7th, 1992 by Warner Brothers and Malpasso Production. It grossed over $101 million in the US and Canada and $159 million worldwide on a $14 million budget. Oh, I have poor reviews, but it actually got rave reviews. That's the one thing that I keep forgetting to change on these scripts, is because I just copy over the last script. I don't actually make, I just cut and paste and copy. And that's the one thing I forget, is to change that. But yeah, I had rave reviews. Everybody loved it. And then we'll go into the reviews later on. But that $14 million budget, it looks suspicious to me, because that Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman, and I can see Morgan Freeman not like costing a lot of money, but Clint Eastwood, I can't see him doing a movie for less than $14 million. But on the flip side, he did produce the movie. He did direct the movie. So he
Yeah. So he's getting it on the back end.
Yes, for sure.
He's a producer and director of it. That's, you know, it's like the kind of thing that Mel Gibson did on that Jesus movie, you know, and he made a killing on that, you know, doesn't pay himself anything as an actor, but then he gets such a large percentage of the gross at being an executive producer, an EP on it, that it becomes worth it. Actors cut deals like this all the time. They'll take very little, then they'll take it on the back end, and sometimes they'll make more. Like, famously, who was the first Joker there? Jack Nicholson did that, struck a very good deal, where he got basically nothing as an actor to do the Joker, everything on the back end, including percentages of toys sold, this kind of thing, and just made a killing on the back end.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's from a business standpoint, it can be more beneficial to not take a limited sum as an actor.
Right. And for Jack Nicholson, that was a risk, because a movie like a superhero movie of that scale hadn't been done before. Well, it hadn't been done in a long time. Not since like Superman, like in the 1970s and maybe the mid 70s. So it was like, okay, we're going to see if this works, right?
Yeah. And he made a smart gamble and it completely worked out, obviously. Yeah.
Right. So we're going to get into the people who starred in this movie. Why don't you head us off?
Well, the big star and director and producer of the film, Mr. Clint Eastwood, plays the main star, the lead, Bill Money.
Next up is Gene Hackman as Bill Daggett. I just now noticed that they're both named Bill or William or Will. They could be all three.
Mm-hmm. Morgan Freeman plays Ned Logan.
Richard Harris plays English Bob.
James Woolvitt is the Schofield kid.
Saul Rubinek plays W.W. Beauchamp.
Frances Fisher is Strawberry Alice.
Anna Thompson plays Delilah Fitzgerald.
And Anthony James plays Skinny Dubois.
Yeah, and obviously there are more people who are in this movie. I just kind of put down some of the main actors that were featured. And as we have mentioned earlier, this movie was directed by Clint Eastwood. He's also directed Cry Macho, J. Edgar, and Gran Torino. You know what's funny is that I haven't seen all of Clint Eastwood movies that he directed, but I've never seen a bad one, right?
Yeah, he seems to have a knack for it. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, and the actors that he's worked with really like his direction.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that as well. Yeah, he's like a great director who doesn't do too many takes, which is, I think, why the actors love him so much. We don't want to do 40 takes. I mean, if I'm doing 40 takes, it's because you don't know what you want.
Right, so right.
Clint, coming from the world of acting, I think gives him a leg up with that. He knows how to talk to actors probably on set, knows how to deal with them, and knows how to make it so that, you know, it's not overburdened on them, like with so many takes, which he famously, you know, does that.
And not doing so many takes also helps him come on time with the project. Like, he finished this movie 4 days ahead of schedule.
He finishes ahead of schedule, probably under budget, you know, and that's, you know, you'll keep getting work if that's how you operate in Hollywood. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. It's not like some directors who traumatize their actors. Who directed The Shining? I forgot his name.
Oh, Kubrick.
Yeah. Kubrick. And he traumatized the main actress in that movie, like screaming at her and whatnot to get certain emotions out of her. I was like, oh man, that's not a way to go.
Yeah, I heard that story as well.
So who's next up on the thing?
We have the writer is David Webb Peoples. He also wrote Soldier, 12 Monkeys for film and TV, and an upcoming film, Mandrake the Magician.
Yeah, I was scrolling through his IMDb. I was like, oh my God, he's doing Mandrake the Magician? I got to see this. He also wrote the screenplay for Blade Runner. So it's
Oh, really? Oh, that's fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous. Oh, I love that film very much.
Yeah. And the reason I mentioned that, because I just remembered that Soldier is kind of like a spinoff of Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
I guess you can watch YouTube videos or whatever where they talk about Soldier, but there are little bits and pieces that he included in Soldier that you can find in Blade Runner. So I'm like, whoa. And did you ever see Soldier? That's the Kurt Russell movie. Oh yeah, yeah, got it. If you like action, adventure, sci-fi movies, go check that one. That's
I love
one
Kurt
of my
Russell
favorite
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, The Thing. Oh, so good.
I gotta watch that.
Escape from New York. Another one. Great.
Here's the thing about Escape from New York. I loved Escape from New York, but then he did Escape from LA, and I hated that movie because it's like a remake of Escape from New York.
Yeah.
Exact same movie. I'm so disappointed. Yeah.
Totally. I get it.
Yeah. So the music was by Lenny Niehaus, and he did the music for Space Cowboys, The Bridges of Madison County, and Mystic River. So he did a bunch of projects with Clint Eastwood. And the music in it was appropriately moving, right? So I enjoyed it. What'd you think?
Yeah. I didn't really notice it, which means it fits.
Yeah, absolutely. It didn't sound like it was out of place.
Correct.
There's some more trivia about the movie I think I put in the trivia section, so hopefully we'll get that out. So just remember I mentioned the music because that's important.
Okay.
So that's it for the rundown. We normally have news at this time, but there wasn't much to go on. But I did want to acknowledge the passing of Ivan Reitman. He was the director of many of our favorite movies like Ghostbusters, Kindergarten Cop, and Twins. And I don't know if you know this, but they're doing a sequel to Twins. And guess what it's called?
Twins Do?
No, you're close though.
Oh.
What happens when you have three children? What do you call them?
Oh, it's called triplets?
Yes, it's called triplets.
Oh my goodness, come on.
And I think Eddie Murphy is playing the third. He's playing the third triplet.
Wow. Okay, so it's Arnold, Danny, and Eddie?
You're right.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
That is going to be appropriately ridiculous, but I look forward to seeing it.
And I would watch that. Yeah.
And I like seeing that Ivan Reitman's legacy is carrying on. Did you see Ghostbusters Afterlife?
I did not see that. Would you recommend it?
Yes, I would recommend it.
Oh, okay.
Especially like there are some people who didn't like it. They didn't like I don't want to say they didn't like it. It was like it wasn't like funny like the original Ghostbusters. It wasn't funny like that. It was more nostalgia driven, right? So but I like the movie because there's a little girl in there who plays Spangler's granddaughter, and she is so adorable, and I truly enjoyed her. He's like, she acts just like him. The movie kind of plays it that you're not supposed to know who she is until like the end of the movie, but that's kind of dumb because who hides that? Who hides who your grandfather is? Like you, it's not like you. It's like you have his name. So what are you doing? But anyways, it's amazing how she carries a movie. She tells these jokes that are not funny, but they're funny because they're not funny. Right. So she's adorable. And then at the end of the movie, it's like full on nostalgia. So it's literally like, you don't know if you want to laugh or cry. I mean, it's just like that at the end. So I highly recommend it if you like the first movie or the original Ghostbusters. Yeah. And have you seen any movies lately that you enjoyed? Like since Spider-Man No Way Home, because we know you enjoyed that. Anything after that?
What have I watched? I haven't watched a movie in a bit. And I watched an anime film that I really liked called Vampire D Bloodlust.
Oh my goodness. Where'd you see that at?
Oh, where did I watch it? Oh, it's on YouTube for free. So yeah, okay. I watched it on YouTube. Not a very high definition version, but
right.
This is an anime from the late 90s, I believe, or early 2000s.
Yeah.
Very
it's
well
around
done.
That era.
Yeah, I just loved it so much. Yeah, it really, really blew me away. I'll watch it again. I really liked it.
I watched the original Hunter Vampire D, and that's and I really love that movie. He has a hand that has a face on it that eats.
Yeah,
Kirk.
That was very strange, right? The hand keeps giving him shit. Like, I told you to get out of the sun, you idiot. Wow, you saw that movie too? That's so cool.
I don't know if it was the same movie, but I remember watching
the
movie
features
him. Right, right.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's it.
I've been itching to see that again, but it's not streaming anywhere. It's not you can't buy the original. And then if you happen to find one, it's like a version where they change the dialogue and everything. So yeah, it's very hard to find.
There is a version on YouTube. It's not very high definition though. So, and
right.
The artwork's pretty damn good too. So I'd imagine I would rather see it in a high definition format, but it's still the whole thing's on there. It's,
right.
it's a great story. It's really cool. Really weird.
Right.
And pretty violent. I loved it so much.
Right. Right.
So much.
Yeah. So the movies I've seen recently were, me and Zach saw, Moonfall. I advise you to avoid it at all costs. So first warning was that it was a Roland Emmerich movie. So I was like, I don't know, Roland. I've given you chances time and time again to entertain me, and you failed every single time. And then I saw the movie. I was like, Roland, how dare you? You did it again. You fooled me, thinking that it was going to be great. Damn you, Roland Emmerich.
You gave him your money again.
Yeah, yeah. You got me. And really, I only really saw it because I really like Halle Berry. So I'll even watch her in bad movies. But I was just so upset that he took a really cool concept and he messed it up. But that's what you can expect from him. And then we saw Death of the Nile, which that was a pretty good movie. It was my first time I've seen an entire Perrault story. It's a movie based on Hercule Poirot. Is a character that's written by Agatha Christie. So he's like James Bond, and he's been translated so many times. There's so many different TV shows and movies. It's like he's been around forever. So I've been aware of him, but this is the first time I've seen an entire movie featuring him. So and it was okay. It wasn't super fantastic. It was okay. And then we watched Uncharted, and I don't care what the critic says. This is a great movie. I don't know. It was so good.
It was like, okay.
Finally a great movie. It was like it gave me all the things that I needed from an action movie. It's kind of like it's kind of like Indiana Jones, or what's his name? The other guy that was before Indiana Jones. It was a movie like that, but it was really good, and I liked the themes. It filled in all the spaces.
Oh, that's great. Okay, good. I'll check that out too, because I love Indiana Jones type adventure movies.
Yeah,
I like that stuff.
So what was your favorite parts of, well, first of all, did you like Unforgiven?
I loved it very much.
Yep. So what are some of your favorite parts of Unforgiven?
I really like when the kid makes his first kill. I thought that was really, because you can just see that he's going through a lot of confusion and emotions. Good actor, by the way. Young.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the talk that he and Bill have afterward, where the kid basically says he's not going to kill anymore.
Right, right.
And then Bill says, it's a hell of a thing killing a man.
Yeah, I think
that Bill line is something like, along. It's like, that line is so great. I was like, it really hit me. It was like, he says, it's a hell of a thing killing a man, taking away, something like taking away everything he's got or is ever going to be.
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah,
it's like it's such a powerful line.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I remember.
And you can
that
see
line.
In Clint's face, Clint is the embodiment of killing, and he knows it. It's coming from a deep place. He's obviously thought about it, and then you have this young kid who had never killed before, and the young kid was so eager to kill, but didn't realize what it really means to kill.
Yeah.
So they have that moment, and the kid decides he's never going to kill again. But we all know that Bill will kill again. Because now he's now got to go avenge his friend. Which is another great scene when he takes them all out in that bar. When he arrives in that bar with the shotgun there, that scene is so great.
Yeah.
So great.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, aren't you wondering why nobody pulls a gun on him and takes a shot at him? Like, because he's surrounded, you know. I mean, obviously you can't really do that for the sake of the movie. Like, it's better if that doesn't happen, but it's like not really realistic. But I still loved it a lot. I still loved it a lot. And that moment where he shoots the owner of the place, and then he got one shell left for Gene Hackman. That scene's incredible too. Yeah, really, really great.
Yeah. I think what it is that they don't draw, because they're not really gunfighters either, right? They're just they're like regular guys that have. And it's like back then there was no like police academy or anything like that. There was no deputy academy. They would just, you seem like a good guy here, have a badge and just walk. And then most of the people are peaceful anyway. So it's like a situation they've never dealt before. So they come across somebody who's a real hard hardcore killer, and it's not some, and they're instantly afraid, right? So, and yeah, that was a great scene. He's like, who runs this shit house?
Yeah, who runs this shit house?
Right. And it's like, nobody.
That line is so good. Right? This line is so good. Like, who runs this shit house?
It's like, what about you, fat man? It's like, nobody wants to speak. And then the owner speaks up and then like instantly killed. It's like, dude, that's what you get for decorating this place with my friend. Right.
That's right. So, oh, yes. My God. That line is great as well.
Yeah.
That line is so good.
Yeah.
Decorating this place with my friend.
Yeah.
Another scene that I thought was, it's a small part. And I wouldn't say it's a scene, but a little aspect of it that I thought was pretty cool is when they're doing the first shootout with those guys. Yes. It might be the second shootout. It's just the kid and Clint at this point, and Clint injures one of the guys.
Right.
And they want to get him water.
Right.
And then Bill, the character Bill, just says, "Yeah, go get him some water. Get him water." He's like, "You're not going to shoot us?" "No, we're not going to shoot. Just give him some water." They let him run to their partner who's dying to give him water, which I thought was very.
Right. Right. That was
a lot of honor in there. Yeah. Right?
That was one really of cool. That was one of Zach's favorite scenes, right?
Yeah, so we it's watched so great, it. Right?
And so, like, he reminded me about this. So, the whole scene is like they track down one of the first guys. They're contracted to kill two men. So they find the first guy. They're at like, I don't know, in the middle of nowhere, it seems. And so it's just Clint, or that he plays Bill, and then it's actually the whole group. So it's Bill, it's Ned, right, played by Morgan Freeman, and the kid. So it's funny, right? Because Ned is trying to shoot this kid, but he can't do it. He cannot bring himself to kill this kid because the kid is trapped under a horse. He can't move. You know, he has a clear shot. He can't get to cover. Everybody else is running to cover. He just has to kill this kid and go, and he can't do it. And so he gives his rifle over to Will or Bill, however you want to use his name. And then William. And then William is trying to shoot. He can't shoot this rifle. Like, of the three of them, Ned is the best shot, and Ned has lost his nerve. He can't kill no more. And so Will takes the rifle, and first he shoots under, and then he shoots over. It's like he's having a hard time shooting this kid. And then, and all the while, the kid that's with them, the Schofield kid, he's going, "Did you hit him? Did you hit him?" Because he can't see anything. He's blind in the back, right?
That's right. That's right.
He calls himself a gunslinger, but he cannot see past like maybe 50 meters, probably less than that. "Hey, did you get him?" And it's like, he just won't shut up. And they don't tell him to shut up. He's just like all into it. And then finally, Will hits him, the guy with the gut wound, and the guy managed to crawl under. And then, like, going to the part you said, he's like, you're like, "I'm shot. I'm dying. I'm thirsty. I'm so thirsty." And he kept saying, and then finally Bill says, "Get him some water, goddammit."
That's right. "Get him some water, goddammit.
We ain't going to shoot. We ain't going to shoot. Just get him some water." Like, he knows the guy is dead. So, and it's funny how calm and collected he was. Like, because when the kid finally asked, "Is he dead?" And even while the kid was still alive, Will says, "Yeah, he's dead." It's like he knows he killed them. He got him with a gunshot with a pretty high powerful rifle. So he knows, and it's like ain't no hospital in that area. So yeah, he knows the kid is dead. Yep. And then just waits. They wait there until the guy said, "You done killed him, you murderer." So they know he's dead. So they leave. And they were treated right. That was amazing. Didn't kill the dudes because they weren't contracted to kill them. They were contracted to kill that kid. And they did that, so they were out of there. But yeah, that was a very powerful scene. So what else did you caught your fancy?
What else caught my fancy? I liked when the two bad guys, I don't call them bad guys to keep it simple, went back to the whorehouse to deliver the ponies, the horses, and the women told them. Basically, they can go shove it, you know. They try and give an extra pony to the girl who's been cut up, and they tell them that they can go suck it, you know, basically right. Get out. I thought that was pretty cool, too. That was pretty powerful.
And they were throwing what looks like cow manure at them or horse.
Yeah. That's what it looks like. Yeah. In fact, there's like this nice shot where he's talking, and then it just comes from off screen, just plop right in his face.
right.
and the owner of the place can't even get the girls to stop throwing shit.
Right.
It's very funny. It's very funny right. scene and powerful. And you know, I loved it. And I was like, and I was like on the side of the women. Yeah, screw these guys.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You know, what's amazing is that I hardly have any memories of all of, like, especially the beginning. The beginning was so brutal. Like with the dude cutting up the girl and all, it's so brutal. And I was like, I have no memory. I must have blocked this out.
Yeah, it's very brutal. Yeah. I also love the scene between Gene Hackman and the Englishman. I thought that was
yes, that was amazing.
Especially the indoor with the when he's talking to the writer and he gives him the gun.
Yes.
And the writer can't pull the trigger, and then he says, what if I give it to the guy in the cell? And then Gene Hackman's character says, give it to him. That scene was like super tense. It was very tense.
Yeah.
I loved it. Like, that was great.
What if I give it to him? Give it to him. Right. He's like angry. Do you watch Star Trek at all?
I've watched some Star Trek. Yeah.
Okay. So not you're not like watching Next Generation over and over again. Okay, never mind.
No, never.
I'll bring that up because that guy, the biographer, he was in one of the Star Trek episodes.
Well, he's been in a lot of movies. I've seen that guy. Yeah.
So yeah, he gives the gun to the English. He offers the gun to the Englishman, and the Englishman doesn't take it, which is awesome. English Bob.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and English Bob doesn't take it.
Right. And he was, at first he was disappointed, because then Bill, the other Bill, the evil Bill, takes the gun. And he starts to unload it. So there were rounds in it, right?
Sure.
He plops out 5 rounds. And see, and you see the look on English Bob's face, because English Bob's like, oh, I could have shot him. And then you realize that there were only 5 rounds. And because so the very first chamber was unloaded. So had English Bob taken a gun and tried to shoot, he would have had an empty chamber and Bill would have killed him.
And he would have got it. Yeah.
Right. He would have got it. And then when he saw that, he was like, well, thank God I didn't take the gun. But it was kind of messed up how, like, he came to town, he tried to bogart and keep him his gun. And then Bill was able to get his gun and then kick the shit out of him right in the middle of town.
Yeah. It was great.
It was crazy. So yeah, it was little Bill is a very brutal sheriff. He's very it's like a lot of unnecessary violence, a lot of stop and frisk action going on in that town.
Well, they give you enough background for him. There are hints, maybe not enough for some people, but it was pretty clear to me with all the hints that he came from rough places.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They keep mentioning those towns that he came from, and he keeps referring to it, whatever, Kansas or whatever the hell. I can't remember, but they mention it again and again. He came from a place that was much wilder, much more violent, and he handled his business there. So that's his background. And that's it, kind of his character is developed in that kind of environment. And now he's bringing that to a somewhat quieter place. So he's still being very draconian and a big time kind of sort of he's governing with a very strong iron hand. A less violent town. And this is why he doesn't even let a single gun in. You have to turn in the guns.
Right.
You know, he's really gone this way because he comes from a place where he saw what happens when you have too many guns and too many outlaws and whatnot. And he's a badass. And so some people in the town might think it's too harsh, but then others get to sleep at night. It was quite dangerous. So, you know, kind of a bad guy, but you know, there's a place for that back then.
I feel like he's one of two. He's either had a criminal background before in like a past life, or he's kind of a corrupt cop or whatever. But he's a real hard dude, bringing a hard justice. He doesn't bring it when the ladies need it.
Yeah.
Like the lady had her face cut up, and then they call him to deal the justice. And he gives them a light touch. It's like, oh yeah, we'll just give him like your cattle and whatnot. And I ain't even going to whip you. Right. That's kind of messed up.
I thought he should have whipped them. It seemed like in that moment, he was simply appeasing the owner of the place by an exchange of property. And he probably felt, well, as long as the owner is satisfied, my duty's done here. He probably felt that way because, I mean, it's hard to judge now because we don't live in a world, at least in our culture, where there's prostitutes, but they're obvious. They're looked at as subhuman back then. So why would you have to appeal to prostitutes and make and appease them? They're not even human. They're not even full human. Right. You know, they probably looked at prostitutes the way they looked at slaves back then.
Right.
That they're just not worthy enough to satisfy. So he's satisfied the business owner, and he's like that. He probably felt that's enough. That's enough.
Right.
But like everybody, the prostitutes too, they're human beings. You know, they are people, and not property.
Even the bar owner referred to them as property.
Yes, he does. Right.
He was like,
The girl that was cut, he says, I bought her from Boston. I brought her out. You know what I mean? Like, it's clear that this is property. He went out and purchased her and brought her there. Like, that's the way, I guess, you know, I guess they treated women of the night that way back then. So for him not to appease them probably was common for when it came to justice. I mean, is any court going to give, you know, work in the favor of a prostitute back then? Probably not. If there were courts. So in his mind, he satisfied the business owner, and that's sufficient. And that's proper probably. And that was probably very common to do that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty harsh, but it was like the prostitutes, the sex workers, they obviously wanted to take things in their own hands. We wanted to, it was an interesting, a funny moment when they were pooling their money together. And like the head sex worker was talking to a girl who's like, so how much you got? She was like, oh, $220, and looked at her like, what the fuck have you been doing? Yeah.
Right? She alludes that she's been sleeping with skinny, right? She alludes that she's been giving it up to the guy, the owner, right? Right. Yeah. Cause she's got, So for your listeners, like everyone, the women give it, how much money do you have? And the numbers are like $40 or whatever. It's like small change. And then this one woman's got over 200, like, which blows them all away.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. $245. Like, which, and it's like fast forward, like they pulled together $1,000 to hire a gunslinger to bring about the justice they deserve. So basically murdering the two guys that cut up one of their girls. So, when you have the three that finally take the job, that's Bill, Ned, and the kid, they're going to have to split it three ways. So that comes up to $333. So that is almost as much as that one girl had. Yeah. She had $245. So she had a lot of money.
Yeah, she
right?
did. That's a lot of money back then, apparently. Yeah.
Yeah, she had squirreled away a lot of money. She did good work. Let's just put it that way.
She must have.
Also, another one of my favorite parts is so this is going back to the biographer scene, and where he's telling the true story of, so the biographer is traveling with English Bob. He is English Bob's biographer, and English Bob, the name of the biography is The Duke of Death, but Little Bill, the sheriff, keeps calling it, like when he first sees the cover of the book, he thinks it's the Duck of Death. And it's like, no, it's the Duke of Death. And they're like D-U-C-K is the Duke of Death. So, you know, now he knows what the title of the book is. But even though he knows the title, he still calls it the Duck of Death. So that's funny. So what's even funnier is that he keeps saying the Duck of Death, even though he knows it's the Duke of Death. And then the biographer tries to correct him. It's the Duke of Death. And Bill says, I says duck.
Yeah. Because he does not respect. He doesn't respect English Bob. He has a history with English Bob.
Right. He doesn't.
And he looks at English Bob as a coward.
Not really as a coward. He can't. But that English Bob is a liar. So remember, he's reading the autobiography, and it's this fanciful tale of how he came. He's the chivalrous hero that rescued this guy from this good two pistol character, and he's reading this like, well, let me tell you the true story about English Bob's. Like, first of all, the guy didn't carry two pistols. They called him two pistols because he had a very long dick. So that was the first pistol, and his regular pistol was the next pistol. So that's why they called him two pistols. And then English Bob is mad that two pistols is giving one of the pistols to one of the girls that English Bob's likes. So English Bob is gonna try to kill this dude for going after the girl that he wants. And then You know, he tells the story of how English Bob really kills Two Pistol Harry or whatever his name is. So that was a story well told. Really enjoy how Little Bill tells that story and the menace that he puts behind telling that story, right? So that was fascinating. And or I think he was telling them stories in the house, and he built the house himself. But you know, the roofs are all leaking. The roof is leaking all over the place because he's obviously is not that good. And then the Bog for commented, well, you should hang the carpenter. And Bill was so mad.
Yeah, because it was his work.
It was his work. He was so proud of that house. He was like, that was his baby. And you just come along and tell me that I did bad work. How dare you? It's like
Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman is so great. So great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So also, I wanted to comment, how horny was Ned?
How horny was Ned?
Ned was fast.
Oh, with like the women. He couldn't get enough of the women. Yeah, sure.
He couldn't. He talked about it all the time. Remember so Ned.
Yeah, because he asked him. He asked Bill if he masturbates, basically.
First he asked him, do you go into town to mess with the ladies? He's like, no, I don't do that. My dead wife wouldn't like that. Like, what, you use your hand?
Yeah, that was really funny, right? That was a very funny moment.
Right.
Forgot about that.
Right. And then when they first got to the bar, and it was like Bill is all sick. He caught something. It was like he got
feverish.
Yeah, he had fever, right. So he's so Ned was like, you don't mind if I go upstairs, you know, take some time. And then it's like when they figure they have to, you know, run out and jump out the window, he's up there busy trying to put on his pants and his boots and whatnot. Because he did exactly that.
Very funny scene.
And then all throughout the movie, he's taking advances off of the reward
with the ladies.
That would come
that's
by.
Right.
I was like, oh, that's crazy. Right. So yeah. Ned was extremely horny. I can't get over how horny Ned was. So finally, the part that I really liked is that Bill gets the news that Ned is dead, and he didn't know. And she tells the kid she didn't know that he didn't know. And so he all this time is like his mantra was, I ain't like that no more. I ain't like that no more. Like, he's not going to do it no more. And she tells him, and it's like the first thing he does when he believes her is he takes a swig of whiskey.
He does.
It's like his power pellet from Pac-Man.
Yeah, he just takes it, and it doesn't, it's not a big to-do either.
Right. It's so casual that you almost miss it.
It's super casual that you will almost miss it. And Clint, as a director, doesn't make any fancy directorial camera move on it either. He doesn't make a big thing out of it. It's you would almost miss it. Yeah. It's that casual.
Yeah.
Wow. Right. It's so cool.
I was like, oh my God, he's drinking. And then he starts drinking. And then on his way to town, he empties that bottle of whiskey because you see he drops it behind him. He's like, now he's fully loaded. Yep. Now it's like he took his vitamins, right?
It's like Popeye's spinach.
Absolutely, right. It was his spinach. You can almost hear the Popeye's theme song when he does it.
and right before that, when he's talking to the kid, when, you know, he tells the kid, the kid asks something about killing, all the killing, whatever. He said, I don't remember. I was drunk all the time or whatever he had said. Yeah. So this is what he did was pound whiskey and kill mofos. And now we see him turn
into angry all the time.
We see him turn into that when on the news of the killing of his best buddy.
Right.
So
right.
cool. And so cool. That scene's great.
Right. And then after he's fully turned to a murderer and he goes into the bar and they're like, you're William, what's his name? William, hold on. I forgot his name. William, whatever is. William Mooney. Huh. You're a killer of women and kids. Like, yeah, I kill women and kids. And I killed a bunch of other folks too.
That's right.
Fully embraced.
He owns it. He owned it. Yeah, he owned
right,
it.
Right, right, right. He never ran away from it, right? So it's only when he was trying to be the better man that he tried to run away from it. But Right. When he's fully into what he used to be, he doesn't want try to run away from it. He doesn't try to bargain. He's like, nah, you know, I'm here. Right. Yeah. You know what this is for. Yeah. So, yeah. So, and like you alluded earlier, that the scene where, you know, he just basically takes out everybody in their bar, not in the best, not in the most realistic fashion, but many gunfights aren't in the most realistic fashion. As it's like they kind of froze and they didn't do it. But oh, like, do you remember the part when he, after he finished off killing, he starts to leave the bar? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That speech that he gave?
Yep. Yeah. Super good.
He's like, all right, I'm about to come out. Now you take a shot at me, I'm gonna kill you. I'm gonna kill your wife and kids. I'm gonna burn your house down.
So, not only I'm gonna kill you, I'm gonna kill your wife and kids. I'm gonna burn your house down. He gives a big warning to the whole street. It's so funny. Really great, man. And then they there's like a little moment where a couple guys might take a shot at him, but they don't dare.
They don't dare. And then here's the part that the only part that I remember from the movie, and I don't know why this is the only part, like from, I watched this when it debuted in 1992 is the only part I remember. So he's like, you better not be disrespecting those whores or cutting their faces or nothing like that. And you better give my friend Ned a proper burial. Well, I'll come back and kill all you sons of bitches. He just walks out of town.
He makes his declaration and then.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, it is. And I guess that they're going to do exactly what he asked.
Yeah.
Right.
The few that are alive. I mean, it feels like he killed the whole town.
Right. So no, he left the sex workers alone. Yep. He left everybody alone that didn't actually shoot him. He almost shot the biographer, but he didn't. And the biographer is trying to cozy up. It seemed like the biographer was kind of a leech. Like he would go to who was the best story.
First it was
English Bob, and then he transitioned over to Bill, Little Bill, when Little Bill had the best story. And then he saw regular Bill Mooney, he's the most evil of them all. So he's like, he's trying to close up to Bill Mooney. He's like, well, you could be the last person I shoot, right? So the biographer wised up and left.
Yeah, very right? smart. Yeah, that's right.
Right. All right. So you have anything more that you want to add?
No, I think we covered it pretty good. It's definitely a spoiler alert, everybody.
Oh yeah, my audience.
Oh, they know the deal. Okay.
Yeah. If it's their first time tuning in, I don't give any spoiler warnings. I just look. We're just going to talk about this 30-year-old movie. It's 30 years
old. Great.
Okay. So you see the title, you know what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
The only time I also have special episodes where I talk about movies that I've just seen, so I never give any spoilers on movies that are out in theaters. And it's a very short, like 10-minute episode where, and I'm just basically saying if I like the movie or not, and if I encourage anybody else to watch it. But like with this, I'm going over everything. I'm going bouncing up and down the story. I'm just saying it's a great movie. These are movies I already like. It's a 30-year-old movie. I need everybody to go watch it.
Yeah, it's great. I was excited to see it because I like the Sergio Leone movies, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, all those movies with Clint. Playing a kind of same sort of character, always a man of very few words, more actions.
Right.
And you see that's kind of the same character in this movie. So I really enjoyed it. And I would recommend it to anybody. Really, really. It's wonderful. There's wonderful, all sorts of different emotions and moments in this movie have been explored. It's very well done. It's a great film. Really great film. I was really glad that I chose this one.
Yeah. So Bill Mooney is kind of a distillation of the characters he played in the past. It's kind of an homage to them and an homage to the directors who made those movies. He actually had a thank you at the end of this movie to those directors. And another thing was that it was like, this is what happened to those characters if they survived those gunfights and whatnot. If this is what happens to those characters, if they ever try to reform, that this is the conclusion of that story.
Yes.
And I think he did that.
Right. That's a great point. Yeah. Because here we are 20 or 30 years, how many years removed from the time when they were doing jobs, you know, then when they were killing. Yeah. So this is kind of a conclusion. What happens to those kind of gunfighters in their late stages of life, you know, in their waning years? Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. It's great. And it's perfectly done with that in mind. I loved it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. So let us transition to the trivia, from IMDb. So we only have a few things there. Now, there wasn't a lot of things that was like great, like huge, big blowups or fights or anything like that. Apparently everything ran smoothly, but I was able to grab a few gems. So although the score was arranged by Lenny Nahas, I think that's how you say it, the main theme was written by Clint Eastwood. So remember when I said earlier that there was something that was additional to what, with the music, that was it. It was actually written by Clint Eastwood, and it was basically arranged by Lenny Nahas.
Wow, pretty cool. So Clint just, you know, he has his finger in everything.
Yeah, he's just doing everything.
That's fabulous. He's great.
Right.
He's great.
Yeah.
It says here, this script floated around Hollywood for almost 20 years, actually. Gene Hackman read and, in fact, rejected it, only to be later convinced by Clint Eastwood, who all along owned the rights to the film. And he had to convince Gene to play the role. And I'm glad he did, because Gene's great in it. He's so great.
Yeah. So one of Gene's concerns was that he didn't, at the time, there was a lot of concern about gun violence, and Clint Eastwood convinced him that there wouldn't be, it wouldn't glorify guns. And this movie absolutely doesn't. It's like a cautionary tale. And I think he does that in how Ned responds to trying to kill a kid after retiring from gunfight, or how the Schofield kid, after killing a man, he realized that he wasn't built for that. Mm-hmm. Right.
So it does send that, that message. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So the movie laid to rest Clint Eastwood's longstanding statement that why he would never win an Oscar. Eastwood reckoned that he would never be in the running because, and I quote, first, I'm not Jewish. Secondly, I make too much money. Thirdly, and most importantly, because I don't give a fuck. Since his double Oscar win for this movie, Clint Eastwood has gone on to win two more Oscars, as well as an Irving Thalberg Memorial Award, and has been nominated an additional 6 times. So he was wrong and sounding a little anti-Semitic, but I'm actually glad he was wrong. He's made some great movies.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't realize he won so many, actually. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. What's up next?
Clint Eastwood's mother, Ruth Wood, toiled through an uncomfortable day wearing a heavy dress as an extra, filming a scene where she boards a train. However, the scene was eventually cut, with her son apologizing that the movie was, quote, too long and something had to go. All was forgiven when he brought her to the Academy Awards and thanked her prominently in his acceptance speech. That's a very cute little anecdote.
Yeah, it's funny to put your mom through all of that, and then you have to cut her. That's kind of tragic. So, and you see how old he was in that movie.
His mother must have been 90.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. So this is the third Western to win a Best Picture Oscar. The two others are Dances with Wolves from 1990 and, oh, goodness gracious, I didn't try to pronounce this before I started this show. I want to say Cimarron from 1993.
That's how I would try and say it too, Cimarron. I didn't know Dances with Wolves was even a Western considered. I'd never seen it.
You know what? When I read that, I was thinking, that's a Western, but you have a guy, he's out in the West, and he's dealing with Native Americans. Yeah. So, I guess that would be a Western.
I guess not a cowboy movie per se, but a Western.
Not a cowboy movie. Sure.
Okay. It says here the film was shot in Calgary, Canada, which was experiencing unusually dry weather. Most of the rain was created on site for this film. The snow that falls when William Money is recovering from his beating was unexpected and unscripted.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
It looked pretty too. Yeah. So the boots Clint Eastwood wore are the same ones he wore in Rawhide from 1959. These boots are now part of the Eastwood's private collection. In 2005, they were loaned to the Sergio Leone exhibit at the Gene Autry Museum of Western Heritage in Los Angeles, California. The boots basically bookended Eastwood's career in Western.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah.
It says here, Richard Harris was watching High Plains Drifter from 1973 on television when Clint Eastwood phoned him to offer him the part of English Bob.
Yeah, how fortuitous.
Yeah, totally fortuitous. Yeah, yeah.
To maintain the authentic atmosphere, no motor vehicles were allowed on the big whiskey set, which I imagine had to be difficult. I would think that they must have pulled everything on wagon. I don't know.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Just extra work.
Yeah, but I understand wanting to maintain authenticity.
It also says here, when English Bob departs, cursing at the town, he speaks with a rough, lower-class Cockney accent, confirming that Bob's refined upper-crust persona was actually fake. In a 1992 interview, Richard Harris revealed, quote, I read the script and I said to Clint Eastwood, you know, it would be great if I could play this man as a very sort of upper-class fake. And at the end of the picture, when he gets the hell beaten out of him, maybe all of that drops and you see behind it all, he's really a sort of a lowlife. And Clint said, yes, great, go for it. Brilliant. Yeah, that's great.
I thought that was brilliant.
That's very smart.
I like this. Yeah, I like this little factoid because it kind of illustrates what actors bring to the table when they're putting the project together.
Yes. And I do things like that on set all the time. I love to contribute like that. And sometimes the director will not embrace this. So this also says something about the way Clint directs. That he would be like, yes, go for it. That's very, very cool. Very cool.
Right. And the other thing about this, he did this without what is it called? When you just making up lines. I forgot what it's called.
Improvisation.
Yes. Yeah. He did this without improvisation. He did this without changing the script. He just took the exact same words in the script and he just changed his accent to add an additional layer to his character. And I thought that was incredible. Yeah. And I wrote the trivia before I watched the movie again. So I was looking for it when it happened. And when it happened, it was such a delight.
Right? That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So now we're going to transition over to see what the critics thought. We know what Jonesy thought. He thought it was a great movie. And I thought it was a great movie. Zachary thought it was a great movie. The critics from Rotten Tomatoes have it at 96%. The audience score is 93%. And on IMDb reviews, it has 8.2 out of 10, which is fantastic, especially for IMDb because it's so rare to get above like a 7.5 or something like that. Or I guess because nobody likes that, because Rotten Tomatoes has a 1 to 10 scale. Nobody wants to give a 10 to a movie, right? Yep. It's so afraid. But I would give it a 10. This movie was outstanding.
Outstanding.
So why don't you let us know what the first couple of critics thought?
We have a critic named Ralph Novak from People Magazine. Writes, while Eastwood dedicates the film to Sergio Leone and Don Siegel, his early directors, he doesn't seem to have learned all that much from them. I think it's a little harsh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's not okay. What I've done is
I've included like some of the Rotten Tomatoes and a couple of the Fresh Tomatoes. Now, as you can imagine with 93%, it was very different to find the rotten ones in this particular movie.
Sure.
But there's one, and it was nasty and unfair. And I think that there are some people that say bad things about movies just to be contrary.
Yeah, I agree. This could be one of those instances. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this one's more positive, right? Martin Chilton, Daily Telegraph, a somber, insightful genre reinventing Western directed by a filmmaker acutely aware of the Western's history, its limitations, and the dubious truths of its legends. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. He has the proper opinion. He was right. I agree with him wholeheartedly. Yeah. So this one surprised me. Gene Siskel. Gene Siskel is my boy. I feel like we see eye to eye, like we're almost the same person. Gene Siskel of Chicago Tribune, he wrote, individual scenes work, but the movie seems overstuffed and halting. No, Gene, we don't agree this time. You're wrong this time, Gene. You and my boy, I don't know what happened to you. You're acting brand new. I understand why you got to be this way, but no, you are definitely wrong on this instance.
Yeah.
And Kathleen Carroll of New York Daily News, she wrote, Unforgiven is a high caliber movie, a gripping and haunting work of art that should finally established Eastwood as one of America's best directors. Yes, she has it. Like I said, I have not watched all of Eastwood's movies, but I've never seen a bad Clint Eastwood movie. I mean, they're all just sort of gripping, like dramatic where it needs to be, offers the right kind of tension, tells an interesting story, is shot beautifully. As I can't hate him. I can't hate his work. I can hate him, but I can't hate his work.
I love his stuff. I really do. I mean, the guy knows how to, you know, if you spend this many decades telling stories, you learn how to tell stories. It's just like, he's a great storyteller. Right. It's great. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm down. I'll check out whatever he does.
Right. I especially think of like Gran Torino and how he does this thing where he's making his fingers in his gun into guns and he's like pretending like he's shooting at the kids that that's are harassing right, yeah. him. It's like, it just lives in my brain. Right. I'm not sure. Did he direct Million Dollar Baby?
I was wondering if he did. I was kind of assuming that he did because he doesn't seem to do a movie that he doesn't direct. Later in life, he like kind of directs all of them. Right. So I think.
Right.
I think he did. That's a great movie. I love that movie.
Oh my God. It was one of those movies that was so good. I couldn't watch it again. At least it's difficult because it's so hard to look at, especially when Hilary Swank's character, when she's trying to commit suicide and she tries to chew off her tongue. I was like, it's hard.
That's tough, it's like
my heart breaks when I see that. So yeah, it's crazy. But a lot of the movies that like he just stars in, they may not all be good, but most of the movies that he actually directs, it's like, man, these are just great movies.
Yeah, I agree.
So So finally, Unforgiving is, as of this recording, available for free on HBO Max. Next week, we'll be joined by Jim O'Donnell and Kai Bobby from the fabulous Rotten Tomatoes podcast, where they examine entire series of movies. Next week, they'll be here on this show to talk about, and this is a surprise to them too, Roadhouse, starring Patrick Swayze. One last time, if you like this show, then please help us grow. You can do this by subscribing, rating, or reviewing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser.com, or your favorite podcast app. And do us a favor, tell all your friends about us. Believe me, it matters. Don't forget, you can contact us with any questions, comments, or suggestions at fanmail@backlickcinema.com. So Jonesy, you got any additional plugs that you want to put out there?
No, just my Weird AF News podcast that you can hear on any podcast player that you have. And it's even on YouTube. I have an Instagram account I'm pretty active on. It's @funnyjones. So if you want to kind of just keep up with what I'm doing in general with stand-up comedy shows, maybe I'm doing a comedy show in your area or whatnot, you can find all that stuff on my Instagram @funnyjones. So yeah, that's about it.
All right. So I've already included most of your contacts on the show notes. Like I got your websites. Well, you have like a jonesys.com and you have weirdafnews.com. So I got both
great.
Of those.
Oh,
down
thank
there.
You so much.
Got your Instagram. Yeah. So they can just go in there and click on it and they will be able to find you.
I'd love to be found.
So yes, absolutely. So everybody out there listening, I want you to be safe. Watch a movie from yesteryear with your family. Hug your loved ones and be outstanding. Thank you, Jonesy.
Thank you, Zoe.